So what happens when you throw a huge Unite the Right rally in Washington and only about 25 sad white nationalists show up, along with hundreds, perhaps thousands, of journalists, counter-protesters, and cops? Good Monday to you all, humans, and welcome to the Reason Podcast Editor's Roundtable version. I am Matt Welch, back in the moderating chair, along with my colleagues, Catherine Megan Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Peter Suderman. Good morning, pals.
Hey,
good morning,
Matt.
Pal.
Hello.
The bonhomie is crackling. So set it up 1 year ago in Charlottesville, Virginia. There was a long planned Unite the Right rally. You might want to put that in air quotes, put together by various Confederate statue protectors, white nationalists, tiki torch enthusiasts, and such like. From all over the world, the organizers were able to attract like 200 people. Maybe. And the main reason we talk about it today, I think, besides the awful visuals of the white polo shirts and whatnot, was that one of the rally goers rammed his car into the counter protest there and killed activist Heather Heyer. The resulting brouhaha out of all of that caused a lot of the alt-right and the groups who were part of that rally to splinter and turn against one another. Fast forward 1 year. We've been preparing, it seemed like, for weeks for what happened this weekend in Washington, D.C., and the sequel turned out to be pretty pathetic. Please do go and read the reporting that Reason did, our own Joe Setian, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that name, about the marches. Kind of kick off our discussion here. Catherine, you live in D.C. I presume you were not at a beach this weekend. How freaked out were people by this in advance? Were people like locking up their windows and doors, worried that there was going to be some white polo shirts coming down? And what does it say that we keep sending more reporters to these things than there are actual protesters?
So I actually went to the rally not on purpose. Like I was trying to get my mom's cell phone fixed, and I didn't quite realize where geographically the cell phone
so
store
you're
was,
like
and so
the
I wandered
Rosa
into.
Parks. You're the Rosa Parks of the alt-right.
I was just trying to live my life. So I wandered into. I didn't actually see the Nazis because there were, as mentioned, only a couple dozen like damp, sad, like masked idiots in a crowd of cops. But I did stumble into one of the counter protests. I think it was one of the more cheerful counter protests. It was basically just like 150 people, an enormous trans flag, and like salsa music. So, you know, it was sort of like, yeah, this is basically the opposite of what the alt-right stands for, I guess. The general attitude in Washington peaked, I would say the hysteria peaked about a month ago, and then all this coverage started coming out about dissension inside the Unite the Right crowd and the anticipated small numbers. So, you know, Peter can chime in here, but my feeling was that people had already decided it wasn't going to be that huge of a thing, but coverage was mandatory, thus the massive crowd of journalists.
I also live in D.C., and I can vouch for that interpretation. I would also just add that the weather made a difference.
Yeah.
I mean, it was starting around 3 o'clock yesterday, just a little bit before the rally, it really started to belt out rain and be generally pretty gross outside, even aside from the presence of a handful of awful Nazis in my city.
There's also the continuous reality of a whole lot of journalists live in Washington. It's really easy to go, even though that doesn't necessarily cause anyone to cover the March for Life.
It's apparently so easy to go that you can just stumble
you
into the rally.
You can accidentally go. Like, yeah. I'm telling you, we had a reporter there. We had video guys there. I was like, I don't need to go to this rally. And then I was like, oops, I'm at the rally. Well, okay.
Nick, there's a piece by Adam Serwer in The Atlantic that I thought was interesting and worth engaging a couple of days before the protest. And the basic argument was that, hey, the alt-right doesn't really exist, or at least as the organizers around the Unite the Right, that's all in disarray. However, if you look at some of the kind of actual policy implications of this sort of paranoid, insecure nationalism. That's all alive and well inside the Trump White House through the immigration policy and the personages of Stephen Miller and Jeff Sessions. What say you to that basic analysis?
First, I want to point out that somebody looking at the surfeit of left-wing counter-protesters called this the Million Man Bun March, which I thought was pretty funny. But beyond that, what Serwer is talking about, I'm of two minds of this for a couple of reasons. One is that, and Serwer does this all the time, a lot of people on the kind of progressive left, they want to equate any denial of first-order primacy to identity politics as a form of racism that is akin to going back to George Wallace, standing in schoolhouse doors or in state legislature doors in the 60s. And that's problematic for a lot of reasons, I think. And, you know, and that's where you get into, questions about, whether or not it's, if you talk about welfare reform, is that always and everywhere a dog whistle to talk about somehow doing damage to blacks? Oddly, when you talk about the drug war and talk about, getting rid of the drug war or increasing school choice, which are libertarian prescriptions for helping people, not only making the government better and more efficient and less onerous, but actually helping blacks and other minorities who are typically the targets of laws like that or restricted by it. So there's that. Then there is no question that Trump has allowed, who has been staging a conversation that allows people to say things that were not, were not allowed 10 years ago, and certainly maybe even 2 years ago, I think, about ethnic groups, less about blacks and more about Hispanics, to be quite honest. And that is troubling. And the most troubling thing, of course, in the end, is not rhetoric ultimately, but is practice. And when you look at Trump in terms of immigration, he is awful. It is not clear that he is tremendously more awful than Barack Obama or George Bush. And I don't bring that up as a form of whataboutism, but we have failed to have a national conversation about immigration and about the ethnic composition of America. You know, we've been proud of being able to assimilate immigrants, but we never talk about what used to be the twin term in conversations about assimilation. You would learn about assimilation, which is how immigrants change to the majority culture, how they fit in. But you would also learn about acculturation and the ways in which the mainstream society adapted to the influx of new types of people coming in and gaining from that. We haven't had a serious conversation about acculturation any time in the 21st century, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the immigration debate is heating up the way, or is percolating the way that it has been for 20 years, because we no longer have this sense that America can or will change and can change for the better by letting in people who are new in the same way that we ultimately did benefit massively from the influx of the biggest pieces of shit from Central and Southern Europe, of which I had and of the Irish types, of all of which I count as my relatives. I mean, we need to start talking about acculturation.
Just to dispute one piece of that, Nick, which I otherwise agree, isn't there a category difference when you are cutting refugee intake to the lowest point in 40 years at a time when refugees are at the highest point in 60? Isn't it a category difference when you are using consciously the separation of 3-year-olds from their families as a deterrence measure to get people
I agree to a certain degree. It's also true that Trump is probably causing fewer refugees than either Bush or Obama. As bad as he is in many, many ways, his foreign policy is less obviously awful than his predecessors. So again, I have nothing good to say about him on immigration. And I have less to say about the Republican Party, where the Democratic Party has always been kind of silent and really like they'll go in one direction or the other. I mean, Matt, you and I both know from having lived in California at various points, the ways in which people like Arianna Huffington and Senator Barbara Boxer were all over Prop 187, you know, which was an anti-immigration initiative that passed overwhelmingly in the 90s because liberals and conservatives loved, you know, keeping out brown people. The Democrats are not good on immigration from any kind of principled ground. There was a longstanding core of Republicans who have absolutely gone missing and have given into, I don't even know if they're race baiters, but, you know, when people like Steve King of Iowa say you can't restore your civilization with somebody else's babies, you know, like, I don't even know what the fuck that guy's talking about. Like, why is Iowa still, why do they get to vote? Because they're electing people who are living in a complete delusional dream world. So I don't know if that Peter, gets to your point.
Peter, to that point, I mean, we have Corey Stewart running for Senate in Virginia. It's getting massively outpolled by Tim Kaine by a double digit or, you know, more than 20 percentage points there. But there are people who are kind of Steve King-esque on that in Republican politics. Chris Kobach is in the runoff for recount for governor in Kansas. He's sort of the biggest illegal immigrant voter fraud fabulist out there. Is it fair to look at the field of kind of Republicans' own internal conversations and struggles now in 2018 and say that that type of Trumpian nationalism is the biggest issue, or are we just being dazzled by a couple of shiny objects of people who are particularly cretinous?
Well, I think it's certainly on the rise, and it's on the rise mostly because of Donald Trump. And because of his rhetoric and his approach to this issue, if you want to look at successful policy advisors in the Trump administration, it's hard to think of somebody who is more prominent and more successful than Stephen Miller, who is about as hardline an immigration restrictionist as we've ever seen in the White House, or at least I should say, as we've seen in my lifetime in the post-war era. Trumpism on when it comes to actual policy detail. That's Millerism, and it is a sort of cruel restrictionism. Miller was the guy who pushed the family separation policy in part because even though it had been talked about, I understand, in previous administrations, where there was some restrictionist feeling, and they basically said, no, this would look terrible, and it would be really cruel. We don't want to do that to families. And Miller said, yeah, it would be really cruel. That would make our point, and I think I would like to do that, and that's one of the reasons they went ahead with it. And so what I think you're seeing under Trump in the Republican Party is that prior to Trump, the Republican Party had been kind of split on the issue of immigration, where you'd had immigration reformers, and not all of the immigration reform plans were great, but there was at least a desire to bring people into the country to legalize people who were already here, rather than simply to cut back on immigration and throw immigrants out. And now you're not really seeing a debate on the right at all. It has all moved in the direction of being restrictionist, restrictionist, restrictionist. And in some cases, the more cruel, the better, I think, for a lot of these folks. And I want to go back to Serwer's piece, which you mentioned. And the key line in that piece to me is that white nationalists win by activating white panic, by frightening a sufficient number of white people into believing that their safety and livelihoods can only be protected by defining American citizenship in racial terms, and by convincing them that American politics is a zero-sum game in which white people only win when people of color lose. I think that is what is happening to the Republican Party under Trump. They are adopting that view, and Trump is encouraging it.
Here's one, one
if
way
I can
would,
jump in real quick, though. Think about in terms of the midterms. The problem, there's no question that Trump speaks to white panic, which he's makes attractive enough to include certain numbers of Asians and other ethnic minorities. But the fact is, Hillary Clinton lost not because Trump motivated white panic. It's because she did not turn out the Obama coalition, which included whites as well as ethnics, particularly urban ethnics. So it's easy to the extent that we keep saying things are happening because of Trump, we also have to look at it at the absolute failure of the Democratic Party, which is going through its own weird breakup, into a kind of liberal centrism or a super left progressivism. They're not turning the people out, because their constituents are kind of sick and tired of the bullshit that they've been hearing from them with no results, which I think is something Trump pointed out. Like when he said to blacks during the election, he was like, you know, you've been with Democrats for how long now? And what do you have? They, you know, what are they doing for you? That isn't motivating white panic, and it might demotivate blacks, but it's also kind of real.
I think that you're totally right that we are seeing a kind of dissociative identity disorder within both parties. Neither Republicans nor Democrats fully know what they stand for or what they're about right now. They're both kind of playing out old arguments and rehashing old ideas, but not having a kind of coherence, a coherent self-identity that is forward-looking and really has a sense of both what can be accomplished and what should be accomplished and how to sell that to the American people. Totally with you there. I just see that the right on immigration and on racial politics is moving in a really worrying direction. And it really looks like Trump is leading that to me. But we're going to see a lot more of this split, I think, in the midterms, which we're going to talk about later.
Speaking of just the phrase white panic, and speaking only for myself, it seems to be potentially not necessarily the most useful way of describing something when the people who you are ascribing that panicking don't necessarily see it in terms of their own whiteness, right? I think people might be panicking about immigration. Those people don't necessarily wake up in the mirror, look at themselves and say, damn it, we need more with my skin pigment than the others. They might get to the conclusion that one from the outside might categorize this. They're white, they're panicking, and maybe it's an unconscious racism, but I have a hard time believing that huge significant numbers of people wake up and say, damn it, we got to keep the whites together here. And I think that's worth thinking about when we use these terms. Catherine, since you were there at the rally, marching either for or against, it's unclear.
For your mother's cell phone.
Cell phone.
Yeah. I see a lot of...
What is that, a dog whistle? My mother's cell phone?
Yes.
It depends on what ringtone you're using.
If it's
a literal ringtone is a literal, yeah.
I see a lot of right of center commentary along the lines of, you know, why is the news media suppressing this, you know, Antifa riot and all of the terrible things that they were saying about no borders and hating on cops. And specifically in one case, assaulting an NBC news reporter and then the NBC broadcast team, at least according to the fact finders at Newsbusters, didn't really include that bit of footage in their own reporting on it. Just on that narrow question, do you think that the journalistic coverage of this event and events like it are kind of soft peddling Antifa because, hey, journalists are anti-fascist too?
Probably, yes. On the other hand, I do particularly hate the genre of protest coverage in which the media covers how those protesters were so mean to the media. And like, invariably, the protesters were not even all that mean to the media. Like, it was like, they threw an egg at me. They told me to put away my camera. They shoved me. And I do think, you know, protests are chaotic, and this was mostly not a violent protest, certainly much less so than the one a year ago in Charlottesville. I think it would have left a bad taste and been a sort of exercise in point missing for NBC's coverage or anyone's coverage really to have been the protesters are mean to the media. Now, it's not an irrelevant thing, right? Like, protesters hate the media because they distrust the stories that the media tells about them. And both sides are sort of hateable. So, of course, there aren't necessarily great stories to tell. I think my crew of protesters that I became a part of after running into them were probably the best variant, which is the sort of like pride parade shows up for funsies at other rallies version. But that's also the most off topic, you know, version of the protest in some ways. So, yeah, I do not think that it would have been the right thing to go all in on protesters don't trust the media. But I also think, you know, if these are the people driving our national conversation and all of them are saying the conversation is wrong, that is something to worry about in the long run.
I think there's also a case of people who argue about politics, just like people who do anything, tend to be bad at it, or 99% of everything is bad, as we well know. I forget what law that is, but it is one.
Sturgeon's law.
Thank you.
90% of everything is crap.
So can I ask a quick question just about the media versus protesters narrative here? If you go back a week when you were on the beach, so you probably missed this, there was about a day or so in which the Trump Trump rallies and the treatment of the media at Trump rallies was not quite the A story, but the B story on cable news. Do you think, and I don't, I actually don't know the answer to this. I'm not sure what I think. Do you think there's sort of a difference in the media treatment, or perhaps in the way that those protesters treated the media? I mean, is there sort of, CNN played death threats that were sent in that were called in to reporters, that sort of thing. And I watched Reliable Sources two Sundays ago with Brian Stelter on CNN, and basically the entire program was about how Trump rally goers really, really, really hate the media. And to be fair, as far as I can tell, they do.
Yeah. So I think it's a little bit different for two reasons. One, there's this line that's been going around that's, racism is power plus privilege, or something like that. And I think censorship maybe really is power plus privilege, right? To the extent that Trump rally goers represent, speak for, or influence the behavior of the state in response to the media, and maybe they don't. Maybe that's a misreading, but, the idea that the press gets hysterical when a CNN reporter gets escorted out of out of the press pool or out of an official government gathering, like that, I still think is kind of a bad look, because it's not actually the end of free speech as we know it and the free press. But
that's college campuses, right?
Right. But I think there is a difference between sitting president is hostile to media and uses his proxies to execute that hostility, and random Antifa are hostile to media and shove them in a crowded space. I do think those are different stories.
I buy that.
I would also add that we're seeing right now, the last couple of days, based on, I believe, an initiative taken by the Boston Globe. I could have that wrong, but the editor there, more than 100 daily newspapers are editorializing in opposition to an outrage at President Trump's alleged war on the free press, which is kind of interesting to look at just on a meta level. We have a situation here in 2016, 90% of U.S. Newspapers editorialized in favor of voting for Hillary Clinton compared to Donald Trump. Trump barely beat out Gary Johnson in newspaper editorial endorsements. This is almost an inversion from 1972, when the vast majority of newspapers, 1972, mind you, not 68, 72, endorsed Richard Nixon back in the day. It is clear a couple of things. One is that the Republican coalition, one of the things that really holds it together, and Trump is very conscious of this, and he acts on it, is an animus towards the media and kind of what the media represents, which is in some parts kind of coastal elitist snobbery directed at a middle of the country or a heartland that it doesn't understand. This is political gold for them. And this is, again, predates Trump, as I've written about a lot at Reason. And he's been very good at doing it. So that's a thing. He is the president, as Catherine points out. He does say things that indicate the exertion or the wish to exert power, such as going after the Washington Post because of Jeff Bezos and all this other stuff. There's another way of looking at it, too, which is that the media, by going full Jim Acosta when it does, to name the target of the anti-media animus at Trump rallies, and to inhabit the role as the villain by going full guns against it, is kind of playing into that pathology. And it's just it's the opposite of a virtuous cycle or a circle. Kind of a vicious cycle.
And the other piece of this is the ongoing, persistent insistence by mainstream media to see itself as synonymous with the press and the press as synonymous with speech. And those are two very fundamental misunderstandings. You could throw out every single television reporter in America from every Trump press conference, and that would not actually be a significant dent out of the availability of information to the American public about what the president is up to. And I think I get why people who have these fancy jobs at these fancy publications and have access, which is the currency of their profession, when it's taken away, it feels disastrous. But I am not convinced that any of that is at all synonymous with a diminution of actual passing back and forth of information and of the freedom of people to publish what they believe. And
there's
know.
Like a non-aggression pact amongst reporters, even small outlets, right? Where if one reporter gets kicked out of a White House press conference once, the entire team, you know, everybody who publishes a paper, who owns a cable news network or runs a show, all has to sort of stand up for the one that got kicked out, even if there were 15 or 18 left in the room. And in some ways, I'm not even saying that this is a bad strategy or that it doesn't make sense. And in fact, I think that, you know, I think being just from a libertarian perspective, we should want government that is maximally transparent and accountable to the press. On the other hand, there's also a pretty heavy dose of self-interest here from journalists.
Well, and it's an ongoing story. I think Catherine is right to, you know, really kind of focus in a way on the continuing kind of melting away of legacy mainstream media, you know, the audience, the story, the way they do business, the stories that they tend to cover, how they define news, which is going and hectoring the president of the United States or his, you know, henchmen and henchwomen at speaking events. That is a less and less interesting way of doing news, especially when the president can speak directly to people and has been doing it. And, you know, when you think about the stories that became big coming out of the Obama White House, the Bush White House, and certainly the Trump White House, they have nothing to do with kind of public appearances or this professional wrestling level scenarios of spectacle and things like that. And there is like really good journalism being done about the Trump White House, about the effects of policies at the border and elsewhere. I mean, Reason TV has been doing some great stuff about how various policies that Trump, either for good or ill, you know, are doing, you know, what happens to actual people. So I think that, you know, part of it is the press wants to talk about the press. The press doesn't want to get up. The press, it doesn't want to have to leave the office if it can avoid it, et cetera. And I think that's an underappreciated aspect of this because we're not, you know, it isn't harder to be a journalist now than it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 5 minutes ago. But people don't want those stories. And, it, you know, you see it again after a bump with Trump because he was good for cable ratings. Cable ratings are kind of in the shitter again. They're sliding down. And of course they are, because all it is people yapping and there's really not a lot of new information or even ways of talking about stuff.
Journalists like this podcast.
Journalists like to talk about journalism, say journalists on a podcast.
Yeah. No, that's the headline. Print it.
There's a natural segue from this to the great...
I'm sorry, Matt, to interrupt you. Didn't we agree that political gold, that we were shifting to a Bitcoin standard for all metaphors of, you know, coin-based value?
I need a little bit more price stability, Nick, although all I right. do take heart of John McAfee's point that in any 18-month period of time, you will see all the cryptocurrencies increase by 100 to 2,400%. And yes, that's how closely I follow the Twitter feed of that madman. This is all a natural segue into the great deplatforming that's happening here. I actually want to throw this back to Nick, since this kind of somehow calls to mind Errol Morris on some level, and I saw you tweeting about him over the weekend. One of the things that I saw before this weekend's Unite the Right rallies was some of the counter protesters saying to journalistic outlets, "You can't interview us unless you promise not to interview the Unite the Right guys, because doing so would give them a platform." This is kind of an increasing level of the usage of that term, and the thought behind it seems to be increasing. So, Nick, can you speak just for a second, both about like the concept of giving a platform or not giving a platform to racists, from both an advocacy efficacy point of view for some who are an activist in the street, and also kind of the journalistic point of view? Is there something to like, hey, look, don't interview these guys; they're nobodies, and you're just giving them a megaphone?
I mean, yeah, that's always the case, right? I mean, like, you know, how many troops, how many divisions does the Pope have when it comes to this particular story? Having said that, that's also how you break stories, when you find interesting groups of people who you can plausibly say are the leading edge of something bigger that's coming down the road. I'm worried about the deplatforming more broadly in terms of not... I don't really care that people like Milo Yiannopoulos or Ann Coulter, who are not intellectual and are not interesting, when they get, when they're, or Dinesh D'Souza, when their college tour gigs kind of dry up. I don't like the violence, but it's like, you know, nobody's really missing anything because they're not serious speakers. It is much more disturbing when you see actual intellectuals or academics who are coming to campus to talk about their research and their work being deplatformed or being chased away. I mean, there's a world of difference between Milo Yiannopoulos and Charles Murray, you know, getting bounced from Middlebury or, you know, causing a big fuss at Williams College or something, which happened a couple of years ago. And I think with somebody like Alex Jones getting bounced off of virtually every social media platform, partly because, you know, and again, I assume we all agree that, you know, these are private services. They're not utilities, so they can do whatever the fuck they want, all of that. But it's dangerous when you start to say, especially on platforms, just as a general attitude, like these are platforms that allow people to tailor their experience so that you can block whoever you want. You don't have to see or hear anything that you don't want to see. Oh, you know, it's like, you know, I just got a blister on my finger from that. I mean, we're like George Jetson. It's, you know, it's fucked up. I think it's fucked up because Alex Jones is a cretin and a troll and all of this kind of stuff. But the fact is that YouTube and Twitter and which he's still on, you know, but they're better for having more odd people on it, because very quickly then you're going to start moving towards, OK, well, Alex Jones is clearly insane. He should be gone. Who's next? And then how do you keep slicing things off so that there are fewer and fewer people that you disagree with, as opposed to just blocking them and ignoring them or engaging them?
Catherine, I'll ask you to follow up on that, and I'll set it up by reading bits from a trifecta of tweets that came from Chris Murphy, a Democratic senator from Connecticut. Said InfoWars is the tip of a giant iceberg of hate and lies that uses sites like Facebook and YouTube to tear our nation apart. These companies must do more than take down one website. The survival of our democracy depends on it. He obviously got some pushback there, snickering from the crowd that pronounces cretin cretin. Then he says, private companies deciding not to let their platforms be used to spread hate and lies is not the same as government censorship. If it feels the same, then we need to ask why a small handful of companies have so much control over the content Americans see. And his final point is the quote-unquote slippery slope argument is right-wing tripe. Catherine, respond to Chris Murphy, would you?
Yeah, I mean, somebody in his position saying, you know what makes me worried? When a very small number of people have a tremendous amount of power over the vast citizenry. Yeah. It's like, check yourself before you wreck yourself, friend. Seriously.
That's the actual headline.
Yes, awful. Yes, I screw all of y'all. And it's true, though. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's ridiculous. The idea that consolidation of power is itself suspect from a member of the federal government. You know, I think there is this thing that keeps happening now, which is the subgenre of deplatforming, which is public official urges private entity to deplatform. And this, of course, is also what Donald Trump has done with the NFL, you know, saying, I sure wouldn't be sad if those owners fired these dudes for being insufficiently patriotic. It makes me nervous. I think it should make other people nervous. I will say that my position on there is a huge difference between private platforms doing whatever they want, including data collection, and the government doing the same, has collapsed slightly in the face of this phenomenon. Now, I still think there is a big difference, and I still think Facebook can throw anybody they want off of Facebook, and to make any dent in that ability would be disastrous. However, as the, you know, the powerful cronyist Trump and frankly even Trump's predecessors gets cozier with the increasingly willing to be cronyist heads of these companies, I do think that's something worth watching and something that libertarians should be paranoid about. Basically, Jerry Tuchilli has been rubbing off on me here a little bit, I think, like just the nervousness about that consolidation. But I think it is largely still the real threat is from government and the deplatforming of idiots and sometimes accidentally not idiots by private platforms is something that we should all chatter and shout and, you know, shake our fists at each other about. But it is not the end of the republic or free speech or anything like it.
If you're being influenced by Jerry Tuchilli, can we expect a future of black market arms dealing and drug dealing?
A lot of explosions.
I don't know why you'd use the word future there. Like, what do you? That's what I did this weekend. So
good point, Suderman. You use technology. It seems to me here that almost every big tech company that has dominated some field. All right. Spotify dominates music. YouTube dominates video, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone who has gotten to the point of becoming the capital L library now is beginning to kind of cave or change behavior under pressure from politicians, from society, from smart people, from dumb people about who can be in the library and who cannot. Is there any exception? I think that Amazon might be an exception to that, or maybe I'm forgetting ways in which Amazon also is becoming kind of an enforcer of who gets to be inside and outside.
Well, the problem, I think, is, as we've talked about before, is that what all of these companies want is to basically be public squares that they own. And so they want to have it both ways, which is they want to say, we're a public square where everyone can come to say what their piece and post their own puppy and baby photos and also talk about politics, unless you're Alex Jones and you offend too many people, in which case you can't, and we'll tell you why, but the rules won't really be easily and clearly explicable. I think that this is basically inevitable for any speech platform, but that goes beyond platforms like Facebook and Twitter that are obviously just sort of driven by people posting words. Amazon does make some effort to say who can sell stuff on their websites.
Oh, they do a lot, yeah.
Right. I mean, like, and so there's an awful lot of
they've been suppressing the search results for that Bigfoot erotic fan fiction.
Yes.
I learned recently because that's what politics is like in 2018.
In fact, there's a guy who I know who at one point in his life was making adult videos that were primarily or perhaps I believe exclusively committed couples. And he had like a series of these things. And one of the reasons he got out of the business was because Amazon made it very difficult for people to find his products in search results, in part because there were sort of family friendly concerns and in part because other products didn't want to appear listed next to his adult videos. And so Amazon, of course, does this because all of these organizations reserve an ultimate right to control who can say what on the platforms that they own. As they should, and I think that's natural. The thing is that what I worry about is that what we're going to see here is that they won't want to be the ones who actually bear responsibility, and so they are going to end up pushing for laws to set out the rules that they want to see put in place themselves. And so, if you look at Mark Zuckerberg's testimony from earlier this year in front of Congress, he is asked about how the site's going to handle hate speech going forward. And he says, well, you know, technology being able to filter this stuff is going to create real challenges. And I think we need to struggle with this as a country because I know other countries are, and they are putting laws in place. And America needs to figure out a set of principles that we want American companies to operate under. Now, that is not quite explicitly a call for please regulate me in the way that I am, that I would like to regulate myself, but I'm a little bit too timid to do so, but it is very, very close.
It sounds a little bit, it's a little wistful, like, gee, I wish this wasn't like my sole responsibility to decide, which it basically is right now. I mean, in some sense, it's sort of like, well, if we could just, as a country, collectively.
So my thinking on this is that I think social media companies should give up the pretense that they are open platforms and that they are essentially public squares. Now, they won't want to do that because their business model is predicated on the pretense that they are open platforms. But part of what I think libertarians who are pro property rights and who think they do and should have the right to throw Alex Jones off for any reason or no reason, and who don't want to see these things regulated. Part of what we need to be doing, I think, is saying, look, these are private platforms. They're going to play by their own rules. They have the responsibility to set them. They should not be trying to offload that responsibility onto Congress.
Can I follow up on that? Because I agree with you, and this is actually in a forthcoming podcast with George Gilder. He talks about the return with a vengeance of walled gardens, including Google, you know, both at YouTube, but even in the way that it's doing search, where it's using AI instead of actual search technology. It's trapping people or keeping them within Google. You can also see this in terms of like the various free products they use. Facebook obviously is consciously modeling itself on AOL before the internet kind of blew apart AOL's walled garden. You can see this throughout. Like, you know, each service wants to keep people on its service, its platform.
And outside of the United States, it's really quite common for people to think of the internet as Facebook.
Right.
And as Facebook as basically their portal and platform to connect to the wider internet.
Which
is
how you get those great Facebook posts that's like they're like old people trying to Google things, like when people just post as their status, like Olive Garden, Springfield.
But I think that the thing that we need to do, and I say we as libertarians, I think, is really fight for this idea of a public square, which doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean that it's public. It's owned by the collective and the government gets to regulate it and stuff like that. But we really do. The only way out of this, other than having like super niche and really kind of annoyingly, differentiated places, is we need to really hammer home the benefits of allowing people like Alex Jones to rant, especially in a world where you don't have to listen. You can move from that booth at the county fair. That's on a private farm. It's like, you know, let's pretend it's Woodstock and you've got a bunch of bands playing. And it's like, yeah, Alex Jones's band really kind of sucks. I'm going to go walk over and listen to fucking Country Joe and the Fish or something. And I'm going to eat here and then I'm going to move over here. But we need to really rebuild a belief in and an understanding and make the case for, because the case is not self-evident anymore, that having more different voices, especially people who you find loathsome and repellent, giving them some access to an audience ultimately serves the social good as well as makes the world a better place.
I'm not totally sure I agree with you. But I'm also trying to think this through.
God damn it, this is my microphone, Peter.
I know. I'll pass the mic back to you, late early 90s rapper style in a dance move in just a moment. My question...
I don't know why I just got made fun of for the wreck yourself thing when you just said
because
that.
I'm speechless.
Go ahead.
So my question is, you want to emphasize the benefits of allowing loathsome people onto these platforms. Because there's a
breadth loathsome.
And a diversity with people like Alex Jones. I don't think anybody here is going to be like, Alex Jones is just wonderful. He's really right. He makes a lot of great points about American politics and how it's been overtaken by lizard people. Like, we all know the lizard people have over... Like, Alex Jones, kind of loathsome. And so my question is, if we really want Facebook and Twitter and Google and all of their competitors and followers to act like private companies and to act as if they own their property and they have a responsibility, then shouldn't we also be saying, well, this is totally fine. And in fact, what we want is to say that part of private property, one of the benefits of it, is that you can say who you're going to do business with, again, for any reason or no reason. Best Buy could choose to not sell to Alex Jones or not carry Alex Jones's
so
products.
Do you think
I can choose to not allow weirdos into my house?
Well,
right?
Two things. First, a statement, and then a question about this, because I mean, you know, this does go to not simply you know, kind of personal likes and dislikes, but it gets to a point about the architecture of speech and public speech and technology now. But, you know, first and foremost, I think you have to suck it up, Buttercup. And it's like, yeah, you've got to live in a world where Alex Jones is allowed, like, you know, to have videos on YouTube. You know, like, fuck, YouTube gets to do whatever the fuck it wants and all of that. And like, we just had a video.
That's totally true. But why should I then celebrate if I don't like Alex
because,
Jones?
Yeah, because
why should
you
I celebrate
don't have to listen
companies?
To it. And you know, no, if they come for Alex Jones, if they come for Alex Jones, what is next going to happen? Because it, when you call people loathsome and when you say it is self-evidently loathsome, we are at a place where college campuses, which are not the hotbed of repression necessarily, you know, that they sometimes seem to be. But we live in a world where, like, I cannot imagine that I saw G. Gordon Liddy and Timothy Leary speak on college campuses. I can't imagine that G. Gordon Liddy would in the 80s. I can't imagine that he would be able to do a speaking tour on college campuses these days. Something is lost when people are such fucking babies about things that they find disagreeable that they will shut it down for everybody.
Are different than
no,
privately
I don't
owned
think so.
Social
I think,
media platforms.
I would question that. And I actually think one of the promises of social media, and again, this is not a libertarian property rights argument. It is about attitudes and mindsets. And if we want to be classical liberals, we need to give as many people a platform from which they can speak and maybe draw an audience. And then if it's Alex Jones and he draws an audience that is large and troubling, then we need to be able to engage that. And because we also don't know who is Alex Jones and who is somebody who is a good person who's going to get caught up in that.
Alex Jones had a large audience before social media existed. I know because I used to at a former workplace, and one of the people who dealt
should
with conservative activists.
Should he have been bounced off of cable access?
If cable access didn't want to carry his show, they should have bounced him off of it. Yeah. And they did because he made the money. And so this is my point, is that these platforms being private are a matter of free exchange between the individual posting and the platform owners.
Are you happy that we live in a world now where it seems as if fewer and fewer topics are open for discussion because people are going to...
I don't think we live in that world.
Okay.
I'm not sure we live in that world.
I take it all back. You know what? I mean, we need to build that world out,
and so in the same way
And what I'm saying is that when YouTube starts banning people based on content that is, you know, morally objectionable, say, that is not a crime per se, I'm telling you, it's not going to be good for speech. It's not going to be good for speech and mentality over time.
Well, so Catherine did this thing earlier where she said that the media is constantly conflating the free speech with media access to the government. I think it's also a mistake to conflate free speech with social media access. That's not what free speech, like, that's part of free speech to some extent. It's contained within the idea of free speech. But if Facebook shut down completely, or if Facebook simply said, we're only allowing left-handed people tomorrow, made some bizarre rule.
Today is left-handed day, by the way.
Or only people from Omaha, right? Facebook is now an Omaha-specific platform. If that happened tomorrow, free speech would not be dead. And I wouldn't...
You're thinking about this as like stable categories and whatnot. What we need to be... I think that the society benefits, and this is my belief as, you know, being libertarian and classically liberal, as an adjective, is that it is a better world when more speech is tolerated freely than less speech across any given platform. And there is no question that, you know, when you start to say, okay, this person is beyond the pale and we're going to bounce him off of this, that, and the other thing, which represent a way that is distinct from like a TV show, you know, where there is no scarcity on Facebook, there is no scarcity on Twitter, there is no scarcity on YouTube. You know, when you start to say, we're going to say these things are not acceptable, and we're not talking about, you know, videos, you know, that are the enactment of a crime. We're not talking about somebody raping somebody on camera or, you know, publishing, pedophilic pornography or something like that. I think that's a dangerous, it's a shitty world to live in. The benefit of the world is when you have more access to more kinds of speech and you can find it more easily. And that, in fact, was the genius of the internet, which was that finally people who were into weird subculture categories, which the government for-profit publishers said, you know what, this stuff is too fucking weird. We're not going to allow it. We're not going to carry it. The magazine rack, you know, has limits. We're not going to put it on there. What was great about
the internet,
the internet is a distributed
platform that is not where the hubs are not owned by any single private organization.
So this gets to
Facebook
my second
is the
question.
Opposite of that. Yeah, so, it's not so a distributed platform.
I agree, but just I'll tell you when with as all of these silos start to harden and narrow and say we don't want, you know, you're either on Facebook all the time or you're not, and they start to limit their choices because that's one of the ways that they control their ad revenue and their eyes and stuff like that, it will lead to a diminished experience. And maybe
Can
that's
I just
a price.
Throw
but
in
what I was going to say
one
is,
last thought here about maybe where we should be looking as libertarians or classical liberals for the locus of whether speech is free and open. And I think that the answer isn't in social pressure or even, you know, the threat of state pressure, certainly on an existing dominant platform. It's the ebb and flow of these platforms in the market. And if Facebook gets bad, Twitter gets bad, people leave it for other things. And we say that all the time here at Reason.
It's
and
already
I know everyone
happening.
On this podcast
it's happening
agrees.
To both of them.
I've left both.
It's already happening. And that's how we know it's fine. The way we know it's fine is people just leave Facebook and they're fine.
Having said that, I think it's always good to be telling people and to be living this commitment too, that it's like, yeah, you know what? I don't know. Don't you guys have people who like won't shut the fuck up about Trump or can't stop talking about Trump, you know, from a positive direction or something? And you're just kind of like, you know, let's have a broader conversation. Or people who will shut down the minute that you bring up something. You know, it's better and more resilient to be in a world where people are more comfortable engaging more ideas. I think that's perfectly libertarian. And it's something.
It's also perfectly libertarian to point out that no one reads YouTube comments anymore for precisely that reason. Yeah. And I will probably unplug from Facebook precisely for.
Should people be allowed, you know, to go to this private question? You know, this happened with, I think it was Der Stürmer or, you know, the Vanguard News Network or a couple of neo-Nazi sites. Should there be a place where people who, again, are not breaking the law but might be vile, should they have access to registering a URL so that they can have
sure.
a website?
Sure. Here's the way I look at it, and we need to twist off the tourniquet on this conversation a little bit. thank you. Is that I to split the difference here? A lot of what we're arguing about is the difference between you know, First Amendment free speech and the culture of free speech. You know, Ken White from Popehat is very much on the Suderman point of view here. I tend to fall more on the Gillespie point of view, but I think it's worth pointing out that the commitment to that kind of openness also can produce places that become intolerable, and it's worth thinking through that and engaging in that. The thing that I worry about, so I'm like, go ahead. If you are a social platform, if you choose to do what you want to do, that it is up to you. It's your private property rights. I do think that that is also going to be your undoing. And I think there's arguments to be made that that's happening with Facebook and Twitter right now as they've stopped becoming the library and they've started becoming the, you know, the gatekeeper. It makes them less interesting. What I worry about most is not necessarily their behavior, but our behavior, not us on this podcast necessarily, though, you know, Nick, but it's the behavior of people out there in the world who right now are like aggressively going through the use the timelines of disfavorable people and saying, aha, you violated Twitter's stated guidelines here, so they should be kicked off of Twitter now. There is a censoriousness in the culture right now, an eagerness to get the deplatform engines running, which is bad. It is the, after all, it's you and me, sympathy for the devil argument of where we are with free speech right now. The enthusiasm with which people are actively calling for even Donald Trump to be censored off of Twitter, which is just bananas. But you see that out there among people who consider themselves to be, you know, professional media ethicists and this kind of stuff. That is the bad thing more than anything else. Catherine, how much do you agree with me?
100%. Always you're right about everything.
That is the correct answer.
I'm going to take it up to 110%, man. I'm in total agreement. And I apologize for taking so long merely to set up your succinct cry. Is it
help.
A cri de guerre? A cry of the heart? I don't know. But thank
yes.
you.
Yes, it's something. Let's go to, let's just zoom over the great DSA argument, because it's going to be with us, I think, next week as well. And it's a conversation worth having, meaning the Democratic Socialists of America and how much they are influencing the Democratic Party or channeling something within it that's happening. It's a fine conversation. We don't need to have it in 3 minutes. So let's go to our end of show, what culture products we are all consuming. And Nick, I want to start with you since you're the one who volunteered it in our pre-discussion Slack channel conversation.
I am reading the early 70s classic, rereading actually, by Charles Reich, The Greening of America, which talks about how the only way forward from a country that was completely broken, and we all knew it, there was a revolution coming in what he termed Consciousness 3, which was the kids. He was a Yale law professor, and it was this massive bestseller that kind of essentially said, you know, that people are finally sick and tired of being managed as part of the industrial state. And we are, you know, we don't want to be numbers, and we're throwing our bodies on the machine and stopping the gears and finding true unfettered freedom. It's a fascinating book to be looking at, because everything that he is saying, it structurally is all there. You know, everybody agrees that America is kind of like stuck in warring camps that are getting uglier and uglier, and like progress isn't happening the right way, and this and that, and that. The only thing we don't agree about is which youth group are we supposed to be following? You know, the hippies or the Beats or the, you know, the Clean for Gene or Barry Goldwater guys. So it's fascinating to go back and look at that and see essentially we're back there, but we have the internet.
I want to go second because I suspect Peter might have something to say about this. But I recently took a trip out to California and watched on the plane Spielberg's latest movie, Steven Spielberg, Ready Player One. I think that's his latest movie. He makes a lot of movies these days. And it was just great. I really enjoyed it. Spielberg's entertainments like Tintin, which didn't really make a huge ripple, but was phenomenally good, are always really fun. It's a story, if you haven't caught it, about set in the semi-near future out of Columbus, Ohio, which is where Nick lives. There's a virtual reality world that people go to because the reality on planet Earth just kind of sucks, and then various hijinks ensue. It's a callback to the 80s. I just liked it on its own and would have mentioned it anyways. But interestingly, that weekend I went to a big party, saw a bunch of old friends, and included in my old friends is someone who is suffering from a pretty bad kind of disabling, degenerative medical condition. Can't work anymore, is having a tough time, like even getting out and going to a party and that kind of stuff. And she talked to me about the joys of going into virtual realities, whatever the successor to Second Life is these days, and how there's a lot of people like her who have gone there for the same kind of reason as pointed out in the movie. And she was talking about how interesting the movie was based on that, of this, like, you have a moment of transcendence from the daily pain that you were living in, and it allows people, you know, stage 4 cancer and elsewhere, to seek some kind of joy and escape from the world, which I just thought was fascinating. Very sad for her, but very happy that there are these places out there where people can try on identities and mess around. Suderman, what do you got?
I liked the movie better than the book, and in fact, in the book, one thing though that is different is that one of the characters, and I won't say anything because I don't want to spoil too much, is that one of the characters who lives an awful lot of their life in this virtual world is disabled. But speaking of virtual worlds that we spend a lot of time in, I spent the weekend playing the Call of Duty Black Ops 4 private beta. Basically, there's a video game shooter series that comes out every year, typically in October or occasionally, I believe, in November. It's one of the best-selling series of the last decade or so. It's a sort of competitive sport shooter, and there's a new version that comes out every year, and they test that version for people who have pre-ordered or otherwise have some sort of pass to get in, often in August or over the summer in advance. And so I spent the weekend kind of playing around with this game. I haven't played it in the last couple of years. The last couple of iterations really haven't struck me as very good, but this one is interesting, and I think I'm actually going to stick with it this time, again, for the first time in a couple of years, in part because it is doing a lot of borrowing from other newer types of shooter games, including Overwatch, which really is built around different characters who sort of have who have innate different abilities that they bring to a team or a squad and are designed to work together in tandem, as well as a new mode that is very Counter-Strike-like, so kind of actually quite old school. Counter-Strike was the first first-person shooter that I really played with any kind of regularity or seriousness. And then finally, there is a Battle Royale mode, kind of like PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds or Fortnite. Now, this mode hasn't been revealed yet. It'll only be in the full version of the game. But it's really kind of interesting to see this mode of online virtual gameplay develop, and the ways that all of these different franchises and different versions of the game end up copying each other. The other thing that I will add is the key to enjoying these games is either to play only with your friends or to make sure that the first thing you do is turn off the microphone.
Also, to not have kids. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I am finishing up the most recent season of Silicon Valley, and I want to make the claim that Guilfoyle in Silicon Valley is clearly the new Ron Swanson. He should be, is and should be a libertarian hero in a slightly tongue-in-cheek way. The episode in particular that made me think this was the seventh episode in which they are about to get Series B financing and instead decide to do an ICO, an initial coin offering. And here is the stirring speech that Guilfoyle gives. Guilfoyle is a programmer who works for the CEO of the company in question.
And a Satanist.
Pied Piper. What? Nick, give me a hot second here.
Okay.
Guilfoyle says,
"There are very few things that I will defend with true passion. Medical marijuana, the biblical Satan as a metaphor for rebellion against tyranny, and motherfucking goddamn cryptocurrency." I have a PowerPoint that I've been wanting to show you for some time.
And then this show has a PowerPoint about cryptocurrency and how it's the best. The first slide is something like Aristotle's definition of money. This PowerPoint is available to you as a civilian. Business Insider got a hold of Guilfoyle's secret PowerPoint. We will put it in the links for this podcast. What I'm saying is there is a show on television that features a character defending those three things. You should be watching it.
That's a wonderful button to put on this whole thing. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to my three colleagues for participating. Please subscribe to Your Reason podcast. We come out about three times a week. This is the Monday version. You can subscribe on iTunes. Leave a review there in great, great detail, please, of how we are doing. And stay tuned the rest of the week for exciting Reason podcast content. Goodbye.
In 350 BCE, Aristotle defined sound money as being durable, transferable, divisible, scarce, recognizable,
Guilfoyle?
And fungible. What?
Can we skip ahead 2,400 years? I mean, I know what cryptocurrency is.
Richard, a lot of work went into this presentation.
Okay.
Fine. But you're missing out on a lot of wisdom here.